This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have a really remarkable individual who has made some discoveries that are not like what you would expect. They're not about the present. They're about the past, which is in many ways more interesting nowadays than the present, because in the present we're kind of stuck in this endless loop of waiting for disclosure, and the latest thing that's come out is a new film with 47 or so officials, people who are all saying yes, it's real, etc., and so forth, and that's fine. But we've kind of had enough of that, haven't we? Everyone saying it's real is fine. People from the inside, great. Telling their experiences, fascinating. But until the scientific community has materials and biological specimens to study outside of the secret government, this is not going anywhere. Not any farther than it has. And probably the defense establishment knows that, which is why they're doing it. So we're kind of going beyond that with Dreamland right now. I want to go into areas that actually matter. And this is an area that actually matters. Because Gregory Shushan, who we're talking to today, has done an incredible study of the near-death experience as it was perceived in ancient times, from the Sumerians to the Maya to the Egyptians, and it is cool. It's fascinating. So I'm going to welcome Greg to the show right now, and welcome Greg to Dreamland. Greg's website, by the way, is gregoryshushan.com. He has a YouTube channel, and he's got he's got all of the incredible academic cojones that we need to believe him. I don't want to bore you with all of that stuff, but suffice to say, he's a former researcher at Oxford and University of Wales. He is affiliated with Birmingham, Newman University, University of Winchester, Marion University, and the Parapsychological Foundation. But the bottom line is this, all of that aside, he's absolutely brilliant, and he's got this. Greg, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you on at last. We had problems last week. We were going to do the show, but the internet intervened. They're rebuilding a lot of the infrastructure around here after the fires that we had here in LA, and it was down. So now he's here.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Whitley. It's a real privilege to be here, and thanks for that buildup. I hope I can live up to it.
Okay. Now, there's a leap here. The book has got a fundamental leap in it, from NDEs to ancient descriptions of the afterlife and afterlife beliefs. How did you make that leap?
I started out actually in archaeology before I defected to the history of religious studies kind of area. And as I was doing my Egyptian archaeology research, part of that involves reading the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, learning Middle Egyptian and the different kinds of scripts and language. And so I was reading the pyramid texts and Book of the Dead and coffin texts. And these texts are basically guidebooks to the afterlife. They tell the spirit or the soul what to expect, how to negotiate the transition from this world to the next, and all of the phases that they will encounter on the way. And as I was reading this, I thought, if you strip back the kind of cultural elaborations and symbolism, what we're left with is something that was really familiar from near-death experiences. So the soul leaves the body, and the mummy in this case in Egypt, travels through darkness, enters a realm of light, an other world, encounters a being of light in the form of the sun god Re, meets deceased relatives, has an evaluation of their earthly life, reaches borders and barriers, and all of these, you know, obviously very familiar near-death experience type elements, but expressed to me, I thought, in a culturally Egyptian sort of way.
How did you, I want to talk a little bit about methodology, because you're comparing the modern NDE concept with ancient texts, and you have to kind of build that, because they, and yet there's a lot of, and the book is rich with evidence that that's exactly what they were experiencing. What was the methodology? How did you do this?
That's a great question, because, yeah, I mean, anybody could say, oh, those are similarities. That must mean they base their beliefs on NDEs. But I wanted to test that question in a more rigorous way. And I thought, given the lack of narrative descriptions of near-death experiences from ancient Egypt, or any kind of statement saying where they got their afterlife beliefs, I thought maybe the best way to test this idea is to do a cross-cultural comparison. So I looked at afterlife beliefs in the civilizations you mentioned. So it was pre-Buddhist China, the Vedic India, kind of before what we recognize as Hinduism today, the kind of foundational religion of Hinduism, Egypt, ancient Sumer, and old Babylonian period of Mesopotamia, and then Aztec and Mayan. And I chose those because they essentially emerged independently of each other, culturally speaking. There was some trade between, say, Egypt and Sumer, and between Sumer and India and India and China, but to kind of suggest that there was a diffusion of this afterlife story that just happens to be so similar to NDEs, that traveled to all these civilizations is basically, there's no evidence for that. And I think it's far-fetched. So I wanted to kind of minimize that possibility that there is one grand human narrative that they're all expressing that has a common origin. And so I thought the only way to then explain the similarities cross-culturally is either some kind of psychological thing, something about the human brain, which then that doesn't really make sense, because why is the human brain telling this same story with these same patterns? It doesn't have like an evolutionary basis or benefit. So when everything sifted out, I kind of thought, okay, this really is looking like they're basing their experiences on near-death experiences, their afterlife beliefs.
So basically what's happening is that, now you mentioned the human brain, and is this something to do with the brain in the sense that because of certain structures in the brain, like the people who criticize the validity of the NDE say it's basically a kind of end game on the part of the brain. The brain is setting itself up to die, and it creates what amounts to an illusion of immortality. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
I respond in the way that, well, first of all, I just want to make it clear that I'm not necessarily arguing that my work shows that near-death experiences really are evidence for an afterlife. It can sort of be used in either argument. You know, people who are proponents of the dying brain theory could say, well, they're similar cross-culturally because we all have brains that die, and this is what happens when the brain dies. I don't think that's the case for a number of reasons, but we can get to that in a second. But as far as that question goes, just the fact that, you know, these experiences are happening. The first documentary experience that I've been able to find, which I consider a documentary experience, is ancient Sumer, so about 1800 BCE, and that has similarities with NDEs in the present. To me, that shows that it can't just be, let me just backtrack. So the sequence of events and the fact that there are these nine consistent elements, to me, shows that it can't just be a psychological thing, because the onus is kind of on the critic to say, well, why don't people conceive of an afterlife where you're lying in the tomb and your consciousness sinks down through the underworld into an undersea realm? Why is that, you know, less of an option than rising outside the body, ascending to another world, meeting a being of light? I mean, all these elements that just happen to be typical of an NDE, I think it's too consistent to be a coincidence, really.
Yeah, you know, the west wall of the entrance to the Pyramid of Unas, where the pyramid text is located, is a detailed set of instructions for the pharaoh that involves him basically leaving his body and going to a riot.
Yeah, exactly. And the architecture of the pyramid and the way the texts are placed on the inside of the on the walls is basically a way of the entombment, the action of the entombment and the instructions on how to put the mummy into the tomb mirrors the soul's experience in the other world. So it's that as above, so below thing, which was so important to Egyptian psyche and cosmology, that, you know, everything has to be preserved and mirrored on Earth in order for it to be facilitated in the other world.
We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Greg Shushan, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, the Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And I'm sort of gobsmacked by this whole concept that we've known this for so long and we've been doing this for so long, but I can't quit circling around the idea that it's basically a way the brain handles its death. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, in my life, I have had so much experience with the dead, incredible experience, which any of my listeners probably know all about, because I've talked about it for years. So I believe that there is an afterlife, frankly. And was there anything that you saw in any of the literature that you kind of reinterpreted, I guess would be the way to put it, that would suggest that they knew more, they were more certain about that than we are?
Interesting. I mean, all of these texts are presented not as speculation or some kind of metaphysical ideal. They're presented as if they are actually, as if it's knowledge about the afterlife, as if they know. And that also kind of reinforces the NDE concept. It's almost as if we're expected to believe these texts based on the fact that somebody had been there and returned, because how else would somebody be able to write about the journey to the other world unless somebody had actually had it? So yeah, I think it was seen as knowledge. There wasn't a lot of debate going on in the civilizations that I looked at. And I should also add that aside from Egypt, I didn't expect to find this. I thought I was just going to be looking at the afterlife beliefs in the religious texts. But aside from Egypt, I found near-death experiences in documentary contexts in all of the other civilizations, including sometimes in sort of medical, magical texts, as in India, where they describe how the soul can be sent to the other world to rescue somebody who's in danger of dying. So basically how to bring back somebody who's having an NDE in the middle of their experience. And then there are just accounts like from ancient China where it's in a very, lodged with the government bureau of documents and very detailed and documented and, dated and signed. So they were obviously very much taken seriously as genuine phenomena.
Well, you know, both of those statements imply many, many questions. Let's start with India. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you found there that you were talking about? Because I want to know the way they experience this. I think that people left and they could go rescue souls and bring them back. Is that what you mean? Okay, can you talk a little bit about that? That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, there's not a lot in the text about it, but it's and to me that it's almost casually stated. It's like, here's just another medical process you can do, the same if you have a broken arm or a wound or whatever. If somebody's dying and you know them, then it tells you essentially how to, or at least that it's possible to travel to the other world, send your soul there and bring them back. And that's something that actually recurs cross-culturally in shamanic context. This is they call it soul retrieval in anthropology. So it's this idea is found in Native American societies, Polynesian societies, and other places around the world. Before that, in the earliest Vedic texts, the Rig Veda, there might be some kind of shamanic element there too, because they talk about these individuals they called Munis, M-U-N-I, who are kind of like shaking, raving people having these ecstatic experiences. And they sound very much like shamans. And that's in the context of, again, talking about the soul and its journey to the other world and how to get there. And also the consumption of this substance or beverage called soma, which is believed to be some kind of hallucinogenic drink that that was used in a shamanic context for accessing the other world.
Yeah, Greg, Graham Hancock has written a book called Supernatural about that has a lot to do with these drinks and so forth. And there's been recently found at Ephesus a cup that had on the inside of the cup, there were the remains of plant forms that would have been hallucinogenic in nature if ingested. And since they were in a cup, it's pretty hard not to assume they were ingested.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, from Cyprus, there were quite a lot of opium shaped vessels, and they found residue of opium at the bottom of these vessels. So
does opium cause hallucinations?
I guess not hallucinating, but it causes an altered state of consciousness, which I guess if you were undertaking a ritual with the intention of traveling to the other world, and then you would take opium and have this, you know, opium dream kind of, you know, Thomas De Quincey kind of thing.
I'll bet you could have a directed opium dream if somebody knew what they were doing and how to direct it.
I think so, yeah.
Probably, yeah. That would be the explanation. That's really interesting. You know, you look across the ancient world and you think to yourself, we broke off from that somehow, especially in the West.
Yeah,
Christianity is like a break with the whole relationship between the planet and the person, and suddenly we're looking up at the sky, and we're kind of alone. When we were more part of the earth, there were gods everywhere. We saw deity in everything. Even in the West, we did.
Yeah.
We lost that. And maybe also when we lost that, we lost sight of this journey. And let's go through some of the different civilizations. Let's go, like, it's the Sumerian civilization, the material you've got in the book, incredibly rich. Tell us a little bit about them and who they were, first of all. I mean, let's not assume my listeners know who they were.
Right.
and what they achieved. I mean, this is, folks, these people kind of come out of nowhere. But, Greg, you tell us the story.
Yeah, so this is a civilization the earliest text that I was looking at was around 1800 BCE. So, you know, around getting close to 4,000 years ago. And it's a civilization that emerged in modern day Iraq between the Tigris and Euphrates River. They had, you know, monumental architecture, writing, literature, complex society, and a very rich religious tradition, astronomical traditions. They had various kinds of beliefs about the afterlife. So on the one hand, the evidence I found was myths about descents to the underworld in the form of the most famous one is probably the descent of Inanna, which in later Mesopotamian culture in Akkadian Babylonian, she's called Ishtar. But essentially the myth is she travels to the underworld in order to overthrow the queen of the underworld, Eresh-Kigala. And as she's traveling there, she has to kind of shed each one of her earthly features or attributes. And to me, that's kind of like, you know, a shamanic thing as well. She has to become this transformed kind of person to undertake this journey. But it has, it's very much a story. So it's very different from NDEs in a lot of ways. And it's not presented as if it's happening to an actual individual. She's a goddess, and it very much has a storytelling, mythical sort of quality. But then on the other hand, we have a text, which I think is probably the earliest historical NDE. Everyone's probably heard, or a lot of people have heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the kind of key Mesopotamian mythological text, and has a lot of features that are similar to later biblical text. So like the flood myth, for example, comes from ancient Sumer. So this particular example, Gilgamesh, in his Sumerian context, he was originally a Sumerian king, was called Bilgamesh. And there's a passage that was kind of left out of the actual epic of Gilgamesh, and it talks about his near-death experience. It tells of how he's lying on his deathbed, his soul goes to the other world, he meets a being of light in the form of the Sumerian sun god, whose name is Utu, and it says that the sun god undoes his heart, which in the process of kind of evaluating his earthly life, and then once his earthly life is reviewed by this panel of judges who are also radiating light, he then becomes a judge in the underworld, or at least he will do when he comes back and dies for good. He meets deceased relatives, and there's a joyful celebration held in his honor. And then finally, he's sent back to his body, and he wakes up in order to prepare his tomb and get ready for when he really actually does die. So it's got, you know, the transformational effect of the experience, and all these other kind of layers of NDEs. And again, importantly, from my perspective, presented as if it's a true story rather than a myth.
NDEs, and by the way, folks, you might have seen some little electronic issues. I'm having electronic issues today, but there's nothing new about that around this house. It's called the unquiet flat for a reason. In any case, we went through a long period in the West, especially, where this was kind of discouraged. Mm-hmm. Once Christianity took over, suddenly there was only one possible movement of the soul after death. It would leave the body and either go to heaven or go to hell. Mm-hmm. Judging from the strictness of the medieval church, it was usually go to hell. In any case, but then modern times come along, and something very unexpected happens. Science becomes the engine of the NDE, because medicine learns to bring people back from the dead. Mm-hmm. That happened to my wife. Wow. She had an incredible NDE because of medicine. Mm-hmm. The doctors in the ER and in the intensive care unit are the modern shaman. Mm-hmm. Because they don't induce an NDE, but they rescue you from death, and yeah, you come back with that memory. Mm-hmm. In the past, all of these civilizations, I think, intentionally attempted to create NDEs in various ways. I know that some of the shamanic practices among Native Americans were darn dangerous. Mm. Because you had to tempt death.
Yeah.
Was that, how does that work into what happened like in the more evolved civilizations, more urbanized civilizations like Egypt and Sumeria?
We don't really have enough evidence to be able to say. There really is, like from Egypt, you know, there's kind of an assumption that there was some kind of shamanic activities and mind-altering practices, but we don't really have solid evidence. From Sumer, I mentioned, similar to India, actually, there are these kind of shamanic type figures that are described as long-haired ascetics who have some kind of shamanic function, but there's really just not enough text to be able to say. I think from China, we also have poetry that's inspired by the visions of shamans, and it's also about traveling to the other world. They're much more colorful and elaborate, so it's things like riding dragons into the sky and then into an undersea realm of shells and beauty. And then in the Upanishads in India, it's these very kind of metaphysical transcendent experience, riding into the stars on a wild swan and things like that. So I think it's a lot of it is symbolic language for an experience that is difficult to describe, that's ineffable, a transcendent you know, universal cosmic sort of experience.
It also sounds incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they really felt the beauty of it very strongly.
But you were saying earlier about the Native American practices, and that's true that in some cases, in fact, there's a sub-Saharan African account, I think it's the Fang people, where they actually describe the shamanic process of traveling to the other world as being clubbed to death. So obviously their definition of death is different than ours, but what they meant was basically being clubbed into an insensible state with the intention of traveling to the other world. And some would even say they would be burned to death. So we have to kind of take some of this with a grain of salt, but the notion is that they're bringing about such physical trials, they're compromising their physical body to such an extent that they probably really are having something like an NDE because their body is you know, probably genuinely near death.
Yeah, there was a movie called A Man Called Horse.
Oh, right.
Which I couldn't watch. It was too terrifying.
Yeah.
But it was basically about a shamanic experience and apparently based on real research into the traditions of the particular tribe involved. Mm-hmm. And it used extreme pain to cause the person to separate from their body. Mm-hmm. And the Sundance of the Sioux is one that involves extreme pain. Mm-hmm. But I'm not familiar. I know a few people in the Sioux tradition, and no one's ever said anything to me about it inducing an OBE, but I can certainly see how it would. Mm-hmm. To dance for 7 days with pierced nipples and day and night, I mean, until you basically collapse.
Yeah.
That might cause an NDE.
Yeah. Well, and there's also overt examples of these kind of religious movements being based on NDEs of their founders. So like the ghost dance, for example, is one of the most famous, but most people don't know that it was based on the NDEs of the prophets who originally had them. And then they came back to life and said, you know, they wanted to sort of democratize the afterlife for people and make it accessible to them in a way where they didn't have to die. So they would institute these dances where they would, you know, dance and chant and drum repetitively for days until, and possibly also take drugs until they collapsed with the intention of traveling to the other world. And you can see images of them, you know, a field of people doing this all together. And it all goes back to the NDEs of the founders. And some of these are still in practice. The Indian Shaker Church, for example, was also rooted in an NDE.
The journey to the other world can happen to people who have an out-of-body experience, if it's someone other than me. My out-of-body experiences have all been very definitely in this world. And I knew Bob Monroe a little bit, not much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just met one time. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about that, and he said that he'd had most of his experiences were in this world. In other words, you go out of your body and you're still here. Mm-hmm. There's no sign of any journey at all. I mean, there's no place, doesn't seem like there's any place else at all.
Right.
And that gets me to sort of circle back to something we touched on a few minutes ago, which is, I'm going to reframe it as when rescuing souls and giving souls help to reach the afterlife by the souls of the living. Is that there's a certain amount of that in the ancient literature, I believe, isn't there?
There is.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about it? Because this rescuing souls really interests me. Yeah. I mean, I'm an old guy, and I'm going to probably definitely need rescue if my afterlife experience is anything like my OBE experience.
Yeah. Again, I mean, because these texts are so ancient, and what we have from each of these civilizations is fairly limited. It's extensive, but it's also limited to a certain type of text through the accident of survival or what was deemed important or what wasn't destroyed later on. So really the main example I can think of is the one from India that I mentioned in that kind of magical medical text, the Atharva Veda. I mean, we know that it happened also in Mesoamerica, in Aztec and Mayan rituals. But they're, and I think probably still are in Mexico, and Guatemala and Belize, places where the Mayas are still exist. But in these particular texts, you know, they were preserved by missionaries and early explorers in some cases, sometimes early anthropologists. But for the most part, missionaries who they would not really go into much detail. The reason for recording their afterlife beliefs was essentially two things. One was justification for converting them, to show how satanic they were and how savage they were and all these other things. And the other thing was to understand what their religious beliefs, to know better how to appeal to them, to make Catholicism more appealing than their own indigenous beliefs. So everything is kind of in service of a particular agenda. So what survives from Mesoamerica is often kind of filtered through the Catholic lens, and what they wanted us to what they wanted to keep, essentially.
We're going to take another brief break, folks. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Gregory Shushan. Greg's new book is Near Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations: The Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. In a sense, Greg, there's someone calling us, saying, don't forget. Don't forget where you are and who you are. And what does this tell you about life itself? In other words, as you go through this, all of this evidence and all of the wisdom of the past, because they were comfortable with this. We're not so much anymore in the West, especially, but they were. And we became uncomfortable with it with the rise of Christianity, and we began to narrow the definition of what the afterlife was, until finally in the Enlightenment, we decided there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. This is it.
Yeah.
And most people in the West still believe that. If you go to Europe, you find hardly anybody who believes in an afterlife at all. Mm-hmm. And books on this subject, as you may or may not know, not on this subject, particularly your subject, but books on afterlife don't sell in like France and Germany at all. They sell somewhat well in England, mm-hmm. but not like they do in the U.S. The U.S. is much more committed to this idea. Mm-hmm. And in India, they sell very well, too, of course, because the Indians have this as part of their cultural narrative still.
Right.
We lost something. And I don't think you really went into, I don't remember seeing this in the book, but I wonder if you have some thoughts about what we lost and why and how. Because we go from this rich kind of animistic religion that's filled with earth magic and soul magic to another religion that is no earth magic in it, mm-hmm. and the only soul magic is your moral state when you die.
Yeah, I do. And on top of that, we also went from, so another thing in common with all of these ancient civilizations is the idea, and in common with near-death experience, by the way, is the idea of transcendence in the afterlife. And that's often expressed in the form of becoming one with the divine. So in Egypt, you don't just meet the sun god, you also are the sun god. At the same time, you're separate from the sun god. So it's this kind of divine integration, but also retaining your own capacity for thought. But in any case, it's a direct unifying experience with the divine. Then when Christianity comes along, that's the antithesis of Christianity. You don't become one with the divine. You become, you know, you may sit next to God or next to Jesus or whatever. And to me, I have a kind of pet theory about this. So, you know, Christianity is predicated on the death and rebirth of Jesus, but his experience during that time, what would have been his near-death experience, is secondary. We hear almost nothing about it. There's a brief passage in the New Testament where it says he descended to hell to free the souls of sinners. So the only fuller expression of that I know of that's in any detail is the Gospel of Nicodemus, which is an apocryphal biblical text, which at some point, I don't know if it was the Council of Nicaea in 395 or whatever, but at some point the church decided this is not church doctrine. This is not important to Christianity, Jesus's near-death experience. Whatever happened to him in between, all we need to know is that he freed the sinners, because that reinforces his forgiveness and his kindness. So I speculate that near-death experience might have originally been a more central feature to Christianity, but near-death experiences, people who have them, they kind of indicate that everybody has direct access to the divine, and that we also are kind of sparks of the divine. We're kind of the same divine element. In Indian terms, you know, that Atman, the inner unchanging self, is one and the same as Brahman, the universal cosmic oneness. And because that's a threat to Christianity, you know, everybody who is a Christian, anybody has to go through Jesus and the church to be able to have a positive afterlife, whereas NDEs challenge that whole concept.
It was the politicization of the afterlife.
Yeah.
In the sense that the church set itself up as a gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. You had to go through. You didn't go through the church. You didn't have any afterlife. I mean, you, what was it called, limbo?
Oh, yeah.
But they closed limbo. When I was a little boy in Catholic school, the nuns would say that sisters who were so loved children so much, they gave up their place in heaven in order to serve the children in limbo. Of course, then they also hit you up the side of the head with an eraser without a second thought. Right. So I often wondered about that dichotomy. Yeah. Although I have to say that the nuns I went with, the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, were really lovely. They were from Canada, and they were selected by the order because they enjoyed little boys. And you know, the Catholic thing is so screwed up. I'm not talking about anything weird. Okay. I'm just talking about normal.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of nuns that were wonderful. I have a wonderful memories of my childhood. And the other thing about my school was that they knew how to cook.
Right.
And they had our food was fabulous. We really, really good. Now when you go there as an alum, it's, you know, it's the mandated menu and forget it. So, okay, well, let me, I don't want to digress here. We're deep into this. Now let's talk about consistency of NDEs.
Okay.
Because there's a kind of consistency in the way the journey is unfolds in various ancient texts, mm-hmm. that you point out in the book. Could you elaborate on that? Because it's just like the modern NDE has a consistency. They right. did too. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there were about nine elements that really just seemed to be superimposed from the NDE onto the afterlife beliefs of all of these civilizations. And usually in the same sequence. In Egypt, it's difficult to puzzle it out because we don't know exactly the intended sequence of the ritual texts that describe the afterlife. But, you know, in a way that makes sense to kind of make a narrative progression out of it, it does seem like, you know, the progression is leaving the body, often seeing the body from a perspective outside of it. So the out-of-body experience, traveling to the other world, meeting the deceased relatives, meeting a being of light. I think I forgot to mention darkness and light, those type of experiences. And then some kind of evaluation of the person's life. And then because these are texts about the afterlife and the journey to the afterlife and not about near-death experiences, there are borders and barriers, but in our cases, the souls pass them and we get to find out what happens to the souls as they progress into the other regions of the afterlife. Whereas in an NDE, after those barriers, they'd be coming back to the body.
Let's go on now to moral judgment. One of the things that's so notable about the whole Egyptian vision is that when the person dies, they are judged against their weight of their soul is judged against the weight of a feather. Mm. And there are the, what is it, 42 laws of Ma'at that are involved. And if you live by these laws, you are as light as a feather or lighter than a feather. You have to be lighter than a feather.
Right.
What does that all mean?
Yeah, it's the feather of Maat, which you just, Maat is sort of the principle of rightness and order and justice of the universe. So you have to be the equivalent or better than that, and basically be able to prove that you lived a just and righteous sort of life. And if you did, then you can progress to a more positive afterlife realm. If not, then you're at risk of being in the later texts that I was looking at, mainly the pyramid texts and coffin texts, but in the Book of the Dead and later, there's this figure who's kind of half hippopotamus crocodile creature who will consume the souls. And in Egypt, rather than eternal punishment or damnation and hellfire, the real fear was annihilation, was complete non-existence. So it's not so much that you're going to be punished by these different kinds of threats and perils that you encounter in the other world, it's that you're going to just be annihilated, which is it's a pretty different approach. And actually, I should mention a really interesting parallel to what you're saying about Christianity and limbo is in Egypt, China, and India, at least, is a very clear progression of the development of afterlife conceptions over time. So in the earliest stages, the emphasis was really not on punishment and threats. It was overcoming obstacles in order to reach transcendence and divinity. But as time progressed and as people became more and more literate and had more access to information about the afterlife, that's when punishments started becoming more important and given in much more almost loving descriptions, detailed descriptions, especially in India and China, where the punishments would fit the crime. So they would say, you go to hell, and now it's depicted as hell rather than just the other world. And if you gossiped, you're going to have a hot iron rod shoved through your tongue. And if you raised your hand against your parents, you're going to have your arm lopped off. And it's all this, messages to the people about the kind of justice that's going to be meted out to you. In a very Catholic way, threatening your afterlife through your present behavior. So I think, there's this old theory that the afterlife beliefs arose because of kind of manipulation by the elite, that the elite were trying to control human behavior. So they came up with heaven and hell to ensure that. But I think they originated in NDEs and then gradually became exploited by the elite as they became more accessible to the populace.
You know, my wife, I wrote a book called The Afterlife Revolution, because my wife was she was a master of some kind for sure. And before she died, in 9 months before she died, long before I knew she was going to die, she began to create an avatar. Sorry. The dog doesn't agree with me.
Carlos.
Well, folks, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. We're back with Greg Shushan. His book, The Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And as I was getting ready to say, my wife, Anne, before she died, 9 months before she died, she began creating an avatar, which is a white moth. And it was, after she died, it became clear for a lot of reasons that most of my listeners and viewers already know, that this white moth was definitely a psychopomp of some kind. It was not a normal moth. Dozens of people in a group at one point saw it disappear before their eyes. Wow. And it was really remarkable. So, but she said to me something that circles all the way back to what the Egyptians believed. She said, after her death, I said, what happens to the ones that, the evil, basically, the ones that do evil? And she said, nothing. And I thought for a moment, that means there's no retribution, there's no no balancing. But then I realized what she really meant was they just disappear. Huh. I think she's right. I think the Egyptians were right. And the rest of it is civilizations became more complex or under more pressure, like in the Roman civilization. The afterlife was politicized in order to keep control over people.
Yeah.
But the truth is much simpler. Mm-hmm. The truth is, if you don't work at it, you don't go anywhere. Mm. Just disappear back into the earth.
Yeah.
What do you respond to that in any way?
I mean, I know there are people who have distressing NDEs where they feel like they're in this terrifying dark space, and you know they're being dragged downwards, or a threat at being dragged downwards, and they're often more kind of confusional than regular NDEs. So I don't know what, you know, the answer to those, what the nature of those actually are, any more than I know what other NDEs are. But they do
seem,
there's something about them that seems to be a different type of experience, aside from them just being distressing and negative. I'm not totally convinced that they're the same type of thing as an NDE, that there really are a, you know, if NDEs are really an access to an afterlife, I'm not sure those distressing ones also are. But there is also the idea that I do think our psychological state is going to impact the dying experience. And this is something that comes up a lot in Native American traditions and Tibetan traditions, that, you know, dying consciously and recognizing this, and in fact, it's implicit in any kind of guidebook to the afterlife. You have to be aware of what's going on. You have to die in a sort of lucid, cognizant, conscious sort of way in order to have a positive experience. And I don't think it's necessary you consciously guide it as you might in an advanced lucid dream, but just being aware of the kinds of things that are going to happen and understanding them, I think would help us to negotiate them. But yeah, whether we fail at that, whether it would just be annihilation or a lower rebirth, a reincarnation or what, there's so many different traditions that say different things about what would happen. It's difficult to say, I think. And even, you know, there's evidence for the, you know, children who remember past lives and things like that. So there's so much about this subject, I think, that's still mysterious. And part of it is because of the diversity of traditions and the different types of evidence that's out there from parapsychology.
It's just fascinating. You know, I think to myself, we've been doing this for a long time. And you know, and for longer than there was civilization, because the shamanic traditions go gosh knows how far back.
Yeah.
Maybe all the way back to the beginning. When you look at the cave paintings, you know, they were probably trying to summon those animals. And with using what we would consider magical techniques. And science dismisses all of this as just nothing, because they can't study it. In other words, they can't detect anything of an afterlife. So therefore they believe it doesn't exist.
Right.
That was not true in the ancient world. The ancient world lived in a very different state. They were living in more than one world at the same time. I know Native Americans who are like that, who live in more than one world at the same time. And I'm sure that's true of indigenous peoples all over the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, and it's interesting from, so my another book I wrote, Near Death Experience in Indigenous Religions, that's kind of relevant to a lot of what we're talking about too. And that's where I looked at Native American Pacific region and sub-Saharan African kind of small-scale societies, what used to be called tribal societies. And I found that in Australia, I was really perplexed to not find any accounts of near-death experiences, because everywhere else we have good evidence from anthropologists and missionaries and explorers of people actually saying, you know, they would ask, how do you know about the afterlife? And they would say, so-and-so went there, came back, and this is what he told us. So we had, you know, and from Native America, for example, I found 70 accounts or references to NDEs, and over half of them also had statements that this is where our knowledge about the afterlife came from. So from Australia, I'm, you know, searching and searching and searching, and I can't find any accounts of NDEs, but I am finding numerous accounts of shamanic journeys to the other world. And I eventually realized that it's not the context of the experience that mattered. It was the journey itself. And even I think what was happening was people were considered shamans by virtue of having had an NDE. And that whole aspect was just not relevant. So we have all these accounts of shamanic journeys to the afterlife, soul retrieval, and going there to seek knowledge, healing knowledge, clairvoyance, all kinds of stuff. But the death and after the death context and returning from death context is kind of missing, which I found pretty interesting.
Well, this has come that sad moment in the show when we say goodbye to our free Dreamlanders. And I urge you, as always, to subscribe to unknowncountry.com so you can listen to the whole show. And if barring that, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Greg's book, wonderful book, is available on, I'm sure, in bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. You can also get it through the Unknown Country bookstore, and it is a really rich, rich journey. Near-death experience and ancient civilizations, the origin of the world's afterlife beliefs. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about reincarnation and the remarkable human journey that has grown up around the idea of reincarnation and how it relates to near-death experiences. Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for being with us today. Okay, Greg, I'm going to make good on my promise. My promise being that we're going to get into reincarnation. But before we do that, there's one thing that I haven't unpacked yet, which is the difference in the attitude toward the afterlife, that especially like between the Egyptians and the Sumerians. The Egyptians had an elaborate methodology basically of reaching the stars, and they saw the stars as being heaven. And you know, every time the sun went down, they saw heaven. And the Nile was the Milky Way was an extension of the Nile. And this is such a universal belief that in South Texas, a friend of mine, Jimmy Zintgraf, called me up one day and said, I found this fantastic thing on my place. You've got to come down and see it. And so I eventually went down there. And what had happened was that part of a cave had broken open during a storm. And inside was this absolutely astonishing image, which I recognize as me immediately as an image of the journey to the afterlife being conducted by a shaman. Wow. It's called the White Shaman, and it's quite famous now. It's one of the great rock arts of America. And interestingly enough, just a short distance away is the Pedernales River between two huge cliffs, and in that river at night, you can see the Milky Way reflected just like they could see the Nile.
Wow.
Fascinating. So first of all, I want to get to the universality of this. Mm-hmm. Now, you said earlier that you didn't see much evidence of cultural diffusion, but there is evidence of some kind of connection between these two disparate places, South Texas and Egypt.
I think for some features that are common with afterlife beliefs across cultures, that it really just is a matter of the human brain, our cognitive mechanisms and how we create symbols are similar across cultures because we have the same brains, essentially. So the Milky Way is a great idea, a great example. Another one is the idea that dogs in the afterlife are either psychopomps, they guide you through the other world, or they're guardians. They guard you from different kinds of threats or demons or perils. And that's exactly the function that dogs serve on earthly life. So there's a lot of examples of earthly things being mirrored in the other world, because that's just a natural way, I think, for people to express them and to symbolize them. And actually, part of the way I view near-death experiences is that it's a little difficult to explain, but it's essentially an almost contentless experience. It's a structural experience where you have these ideas of leaving the body and a being of light in other realms. But it's our the way our consciousness works and our enculturated minds almost project symbols onto these experiences in order to make them experienceable, if that makes any sense. So an atheist will see a being of light, but somebody who is a Buddhist is going to see that being of light as the Buddha. And it's the same with, these kind of bucolic, wondrous landscapes that people in NDEs see. Some people are going to see an idealized version of the English countryside, and other people are going to see a Pueblo village or whatever it is, according to your psychological and cultural makeup. It doesn't mean that those things aren't there, but we just need to be able to conceive of them in a certain way. And I think our symbolizing helps us to do that.
Yeah, Bob Monroe said that we saw it through the lens of our own experience.
Yeah.
That was his impression.
Yeah.
And I think he's absolutely right. I think but there's something, probably something universal there. I want to get back to this. You touched on dog, which is a huge part of my life. My wife was cognizant of all of these things. And once I had an experience, I was meditating in the living room and in the afternoon, and suddenly this image of a dog came into my mind. And it was a dog I had known as a boy called Quagmire, who was a beautiful dog, but the father of the house, we now know, had PTSD from the Korean War, where he'd had a rough time. And he used to beat the dog up a lot. And the dog was so sweet. He was always happy, he was always dirty, he was called Quagmire, had long hair. And no matter how hard his life was, that dog was always happy. And suddenly there he was standing in front of me in my meditative, very vivid image. And I'm thinking, what the hell? I haven't thought about Quagmire since I was 17. I broke up with the girl and forgot Quagmire at the same time. She broke up with me, actually. In any case, I told this story to Anne, and she says, dog, God, you saw dog, you had an experience of God. And I thought, I can't believe that for a second. And I said, well, I'd have to have some kind of a sign if I'm supposed to believe that I had an experience of God as a dog.
Yeah.
And 15 minutes later, we go out to take our afternoon walk. And sitting there on the street is a car parked. It has a vanity plate, QGMIRE, Quagmire.
Wow.
And when you brought up dog, that really resonated with this guy.
Right.
I want to talk a little bit more about the whole world of the animal world and the journey to the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. There is actually, amazingly enough, in the Rig Veda, this is a text from India that goes back to around 1500 BC at minimum. Indian people in India think it's much, much older, but this is the date Western scholars have kind of ascribed to it. But it certainly has an older tradition. But there's actually the description of a near-death experience of a horse in the Rig Veda, which is the only time I've ever come across anything like that. And it describes, he leaves the body, he goes to this other world, and there's this kind of rainbow land experience that he has. And I think the intention of that is to suggest to us, to human people who are going to be traveling in the afterlife, to indicate that our animals are also going to be there with us, that we're going to be accompanied by them, that it's also a realm of animals. But I can't think of any other NDE of any animal, in fact, other than that single Indian example.
Okay, well, all right, well, let's move on then.
But lots of dogs and people who have NDEs will see animals in the other world, and then the afterlife beliefs themselves, they're always describing, animals that are going to be there when you get there.
Right. Well, I have a feeling I will encounter dogs and if they like me. I want to go back now to, we touched only briefly on the Sumerian beliefs, the Mesopotamian beliefs, and there's quite a contrast between that whole set of ideas and the Egyptian one. The Egyptian one is very definitely hopeful in the sense that you can ascend. The Mesopotamian one seems much more pessimistic.
Yeah,
it doesn't. Funny. Yeah, go ahead and talk about that if you will.
Okay. That's true to an extent, but it's also, I think, has been overstated. It's one of these things of received wisdom in the study of religions that Mesopotamia only had this kind of pessimistic, vague, shadowy afterlife where it's almost, half existence wandering around in this confused state. So when I first started doing this research, I sort of expected to find that. But at the same time, as I kept reading, I realized that it's a little more complicated than that. And so the example of Bilgamesh that I gave earlier, for example, where he meets these beings of light and he has the life review type thing and he becomes half divinized, becomes a judge in the other world. So scholars of Mesopotamia would say, well, he's a special case because he's a king and he's half divine and all the rest of it. But there is nevertheless, I think, indication just in the fact of becoming a judge suggests that there are souls of the dead to be judged. And the process of judgment suggests that there are positive and negative afterlife realms. And I found that in other texts that was confirmed. So there's poetry and other literary texts where it describes that there's feasting in the other world and there it's a realm of springs and you meet your relatives and all the rest of it. Some texts describe that the afterlife is determined by how many sons you have in particular. So a person with one son gets to just sit on bricks and eat bread. And the person with two sons gets bread and water and gets to sit on a chair. And it kind of progresses to the person with 12 sons has this amazing, semi-divine afterlife. So that's not really based on royal status. It's based on how many children you have. And then women who die in childbirth also have a preferential afterlife. So it's not really a judgment about your earthly behavior, except in the sense that in the Sumerian ideal, the ideal was to have a lot of sons.
Again, it's a politicization of this experience because obviously the state needs children.
Yeah,
it needs lots of children, and children are essential to its survival.
Yeah.
And so people are being told, well, you have a lot of children and you'll go to heaven. If you don't have a lot of children, forget it. You're going to just sit there and eat bread.
Yeah, and significantly, the one historical NDE we do have from that era is not like that. It is more like an NDE where you have direct access to the divine and beings of light and transcendence and all that.
Can you elaborate on exactly which one you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the one of Gilgamesh that I mentioned earlier.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yes. That was the Gilgamesh story, folks, is really, really something. You should definitely read the Epic of Gilgamesh. Do you have any particular translation of that epic that you prefer?
Yeah. In fact, the one by A.R. George, I think his initials are A.R. It's the Penguin edition. And that one includes these Sumerian additional texts, like the death of Bilgamesh with his NDE. So that's the one I would definitely recommend. The earlier editions are only based on the Akkadian Babylonian versions, and they kind of leave out some of those Sumerian texts, which were only, I think, translated in the 50s or 60s or something.
Okay, so if you want to get into this deeply, folks, try the Penguin edition of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and we think, oh, old books, who could possibly read some fusty old book like that? you'd be amazed. It's really fun. It's really a gas. Should be an eternal bestseller, in my opinion. Okay, now I wanted to discuss the idea of reincarnation in India, especially because it's absolutely central to your discussion of this in India, and as it should be, because reincarnation was and is a huge part of the whole Indian cosmology, mm-hmm. Which I love, by the way. I'm a huge fan of India and India's culture.
Yeah, me too.
I've even tried to learn Sanskrit and discovered that that's apparently not something my mind is going to be able to do. I got a course in Sanskrit, and usually I can do pretty well. I learned a certain amount of hieroglyphics and how they work and so forth. Mm-hmm. Could make some simple translations into Aramaic and Attic Greek and things, Latin. Mm-hmm. But Sanskrit defeated me. I think it's the most complicated language in the world. I think it's almost a language from a higher civilization that might have predated what we know of India. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that, a reincarnation and its relationship to your whole discussion.
Yeah, I mean, even though I was focusing on near-death experience, you can't look at Indian afterlife beliefs without encountering reincarnation. So, but what was really interesting about it is in the earliest texts, I mentioned the Rig Veda, the Atharva Veda, the Brahmanas, reincarnation is not really a part of Indian thought at that point. There are references to rebirth, but they seem to be indicating rebirth in the other world, that the soul of the dead after death experiences this kind of rebirth, if you know the correct kind of rituals and formulae. But as time goes on, there is more of a focus on reincarnation. And interestingly, throughout the Vedic texts, starting with the Rig Veda, there's this example of a kind of mythologized near-death experience story where a father sends his little boy to the underworld, and the little boy meets Yama, the god of the dead, and has a kind of intellectual, philosophical conversation with him about the afterlife and learns about the other world through Yama. This appears in different permutations throughout Vedic history up until the final one that I know of is in the Upanishads. And I think it's not coincidental that around that time is when reincarnation kind of emerges as a more prominent theological doctrine, really. And at that point, the focus about the afterlife is really on the other world as a kind of transcendent, metaphysical, but temporary state, either temporary before being reincarnated on Earth or before overcoming the cycle of rebirth and reaching a more transcendent state where you're then, you know, at one with the universe and you're no longer this kind of individual who keeps having to have these rebirths. And the interesting thing about that for me was in another book I wrote called The Next World, Extraordinary Experiences of the Afterlife, I also looked at NDEs in the context of children who remember past lives and the memories of intermediate states that those children have. So to elaborate on that, basically these children remember not just their past personality and the family and their occupation and all that, which researchers focus on. They also sometimes remember the death of that previous personality. So they will say, I remember I was walking down the road and I got hit by a bus. My soul left my body. I saw my body lying there. I ascended to another realm. I met a being of light. So basically they are describing a near-death experience, but instead of returning to their old body, they're reborn in a new body. And the way they describe that experience is so similar to NDEs, but the realm that they arrive in is seen as an intermediate state, just like in the ancient Indian texts, rather than an ultimate state, a heaven type realm where you stay for good. And that obviously is, you know, it ties in and justifies and explains the reincarnation.
There is a universality that is implied throughout the book, that there is an underlying experience here that contributes to all of these stories, that it's not cultural diffusion, but something deeper. Can you speak to your ideas about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I looked at shamanism as the core experience, possibly, that because, you know, as we talked about it, shamanism seems to be present all around the world at different times. But to me, the near-death experience really fit the bill a little bit better because of the fact that it's spontaneous. It's not an experience that people generally deliberately try to have. It happens to atheists. It happens to people who've never even heard of a near-death experience. So it's external, not in the sense that it comes from a god or anything, but it doesn't come from a psychological state within. It's not something we're planning or that happens in a ritual context. So I think because of that spontaneity of it, because it's not controllable, that seems to me to be a primary human experience. And because it's so overwhelmingly profound and unusual, not only for the person having it, but for the people in the vicinity. I mean, it's an amazing, profound thing to see somebody who you thought was dead suddenly come back to life. That in itself is a huge deal. And then to hear them talking about what they saw in the other world, you know, people are going to listen. So all those things, all those contexts about the near-death experience, combined with the fact that the descriptions match the journey to the other world beliefs in all these civilizations, to me, it's a really compelling argument that that's where they came from. And that then shamanism emerged out of that as a kind of way of replicating near-death experiences. And that also, analogies to that happen in other cultures, even in ancient Greece with the mystery cults, essentially somebody would undergo this initiatory ritual by, again, being disoriented, possibly on drugs, descending into a dark space. And in that dark space, they're kind of a being of light is revealed. There's kind of pyrotechnics and stagecraft done by the ancient Greek priests. And they would kind of show a light on this deity in the underworld. And then you'd emerge from this ritual temple space underground transformed, and that at that point you'd be then eligible to achieve a better afterlife state. So I think all this stuff is like essentially replicating near-death experiences and bringing the knowledge and the wisdom that people who have NDEs into the present, into a practical way that we can use it in our current lives.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because we're all in this situation. We're all going to go through this.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, Anne said, that's why we were born to die. She said, this is what we're here for. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what about the middle part? She said, well, that's what you do. This is your path. This is what you're here to gain energy for your soul and to gain enough energy to where you can add something to the great weave of experience in the universe. And I never asked her, I guess I did say, well, what happens if you don't have anything to add? And she got mad at me. I don't know what her answer was. Now your vision of the afterlife is a hopeful vision, I think. I'm right about that, or not. I can't really tell, but I think it is, and I think you see yourself as going to experience an afterlife. Am I right?
Well, I'm glad you said you can't really tell, because that's that's what I've been trying. I've been trying as a scholar to, you know, the medieval Christian text, mystical text, the cloud of unknowing. I've been trying to dwell in the cloud of unknowing, essentially, with this subject. So I wasn't raised religious, so I don't feel like I have a personal understanding, even knowledge of what it is to believe something. I feel like I either know things or I don't know things. And I think life after death is one of those things I don't know, whether it's going to happen or not. But at the same time, all this evidence, you know, can't be ignored. And there's, you know, some of the we didn't really talk about much about the evidence from some of these cases, but, you know, there are these examples of people meeting somebody in the other world during their near-death experience who they didn't know had died or didn't know at all. And then when they come back, they meet them later in life. Those kinds of stories to me are pretty compelling, even though from a scientific point, they're anecdotal. But I do think that at death, we're going to have an amazing experience. I think it's going to be this overwhelmingly transcendent, probably wonderful experience. Most people describe it in those terms. A lot of people who have NDEs don't even want to come back from the other world. So I'm not afraid of it in that sense, or in any sense really. But I think that, you know, when near-death experiences talk about reaching a barrier or a boundary from which they have to return, that's the point where that's the absolute unknown as far as I'm concerned. So it, even if we do survive the death of the body, as far as I know, at that moment, that's as far as we go. And maybe we're going to die after the first 5 minutes after this amazing, glorious experience. Or maybe we're going to live on after that. And I think some, and then the other complicated thing is reincarnation once again, because a lot of near-death experiences don't talk about reincarnation, but then some of them do. So I don't know if it's a case of just everybody has a different afterlife fate, depending on your beliefs or depending on the path that you've taken or how many rebirths you've had or what. There's just so much, I think, that's still mysterious about it that I don't feel like I can get to a place of claiming to know or believe in any of it. Other than that, I know something's going to happen and it's going to be amazing.
I hope so. I know it. You know, in my case, my wife, oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I've got this misadjusted. Just give me a second here, folks. Oh, no, I don't. I'm good. My wife had, she had an NDE and she came back so brilliantly afterwards. I don't doubt this anymore. I'm beyond that. I've had so many experiences, not only with people in the afterlife, but with my wife who went into the afterlife and then came back in an incredibly convincing way, because she started by talking to friends and telling them to call me at moments when I was experiencing the depths of grief. Wow. And, you know, it was an amazing performance. Mm. And I was very, very lucky to have her in my life. And she used to say that she had given a choice. She said, you could go back if you want to. And I always said, well, thank you so much for coming back. And she said, yeah, I wanted to come back. I wanted to finish. I wanted to see my grandkids. Hmm. When she was just in the process of coming back, and she had ICU psychosis, she's coming out of all of that. And she says to my son, we've got to get this family started. His fiance had been dating for like 5 years or so. Hmm. And within a year, they had the first grandchild. They were married. They had the first grandchild in a year. And she got to see her first two grandkids. And she started got her family going. Wow. But now there are other people the author of Struck by Lightning, and I'm going to remember her name in a minute, I hope. Elizabeth, she changed in a flash. Elizabeth Crone, wasn't Struck by Lightning, it's called Changed in a Flash. And she was struck by lightning and ended up being told, you can come back if you wish. But in her case, they said to her, it's going to really be painful because your body's really busted up. But she came back because of her kids. Mm-hmm. And
this is
go ahead. Okay. No, I'm kind of getting off the subject in a way, but I'm not at the same time, because I sense in the, especially in the Mesoamerican literature, and I may be wrong about this, that there is a sense of the possibility of return, mm-hmm. that souls and certainly in China and Japan, Japan is a ghost haunted country. I mean, if you read modern Japanese literature, it's hard to find a book that does not have ghosts in it. And that's true of many movies in Japan too. Ghosts are a big part of their culture.
Yeah. Just what you were saying about the return and the reasons for the return. So both your wife and Elizabeth Kuhn wrote that they came back because of the children, because of their family. And that's often the case in contemporary Western NDEs. The reason people come back is to be with their family. They need to take care of their loved ones. Occasionally it's some other personal unfulfilled kind of business. Like I need to finish some project I was working on, finish my novel or whatever it is. Sometimes it's in order to teach other people about the afterlife. It's a kind of personal mission. But an interesting thing is going back to the cross-cultural diversity is in some NDEs in India and China and other parts of the East, it's a case rather of a personal choice based on a personal, for a personal reason. It's a case of a clerical error in the other world on the part of the, you know, spirits who kind of run the bureaucracy of the afterlife. So they will say, you know, if I were to have an NDE, they'd say, "Oh, we actually got the wrong Gregory Shushan. You're not the one. We don't want the one that lives in San Francisco. We want the one in New York." So they would send me back to my body and I would wake up. And then this other poor person who has my same name in New York would then die permanently. So again, you know, we have this idea that there's this obvious cross-cultural similarity because everybody gets sent back because otherwise we wouldn't have the accounts of these experiences to begin with. But the reason couldn't be further apart from each other. In one case, it's a personal choice about family. The other one, it's a case of mistaken identity. So, and that's the stuff I never know what to make of it. Are these things really happening, or is it the way, like I was saying earlier, the way our enculturated consciousness symbolizes the fact of the return and giving it some kind of cultural meaning that's comprehensible to us?
Well, we've come to the end of our time together, and it's been a wonderful time. Greg Shushan, he's an absolutely marvelous book, Near-Death Experiences in Ancient Civilizations. You can visit him on YouTube. You can visit him at gregoryshushan.com. You can go to his Patreon. I suggest you do that. And there's an immense amount of brilliant scholarship here and illuminating scholarship. And I think I will, and my wife has, of course, been a big part of this show because this is her wheelhouse. This is what she was most interested in. And I would like to end with a comment that she made that I think kind of fits very well with Greg's very brilliant assessment and attitude toward his own work. The human species is too young to have beliefs. What we need are good questions. And Greg, you sure have got a lot of them. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you very much, Whitley. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.